Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRue Show for Saturday, August 20th, 2011. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and our title for today, for today's topic of discussion, is We Are Now at the Break Point. I'm referring to the break point of the financial monetarist system we've had for decades. I'm referring to the real physical economic conditions for existence for nation states and civilization. And in particular, we are going to discuss this and what we're doing about the future by reflecting on the past. We're remembering a particular break point in history, which was August 15th, 1971. I'll remind those of you who weren't ultra paying attention at the time, that was when then President Nixon floated the dollar. We'll get into that. And Mr. Lyndon LaRouche at the time forewarned of the very kind of situation we would be in today if we didn't take certain measures over this 40-year period. So we're having this show today for August 20th in a kind of 40th anniversary of certain moments of history that in which we should take actions or else. Now, I'm very pleased to have as our two guests, I'm going to welcome the person with me here in the studio, Nancy Spanis. Welcome, Nancy.
Hi. Thanks, Marsh.
And Nancy is the EIR, the editor-in-chief of EIR Online, of Executive Intelligence Review, and she was the editor of publications at the time, working closely with Lyndon LaRouche in 1971. In fact, before that and after it, we'll get to that. But off-site, I welcome from the Ohio Valley, speaking to us, I think, from southern Indiana, Carol Smith. Carol, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And Carol is an activist there in the whole, I mentioned the Ohio Valley, because she is throughout Kentucky, Indiana. She's a mover and shaker for LaRouche Political Action Committee. And she's often, her activities are based out of Louisville, Kentucky. And we are going to do two things, let me just say now, due to scheduling conflicts, and believe me, it isn't due to vacations right now with the pace and tempo of world events, but these two guests, due to certain constraints, we are pre-taping this within 24 hours of our show time. And we're going to take pretty much our discussion with the guests in succession, beginning with Nancy. And let me just begin in this way by saying earlier this week, in fact, it was, I think, on August 14th or 15th, on the anniversary of this 1971 event, Nancy was interviewed. I want people to look at that, please, on LaRouchePack.com. She did an LPAC TV interview with Matthew Ogden, and I think it's titled, It's Time to Pull the Plug on Monetarism. And that certainly is a lead into what we have now. Nancy, in our break point right now, we are not confined by the world of phenomena, but we have tremendous manifestations of the financial system blowing out. Chaos, you could call it deleveraging if you want to be polite, but non-payments, freezing up, this kind. Could you begin with some of the phenomena of what's happening right now in the transatlantic and world region, and then we'll get into 1971.
Well, I'm under the impression that even the ostriches are probably aware of the financial blowout on the global,
yeah, the TV watchers,
particularly the transatlantic region right now. And it's crazy for anyone to say the way the president says this is a European crisis, which is destabilizing us. This is a global crisis of the ruling financial system based primarily in the city of London and Wall Street, and it is endemic in every aspect of that system. The banks are bankrupt, and they are sucking the blood of the states and the populations and attempting to say that the states are bankrupt and therefore have to go through a whole other round of austerity bleeding in order to support the banks. And this has been absolutely clear. We've been living on borrowed time effectively for a long time, but even more precisely for the last 2 weeks when this thing began to blow sky high. And you've had these days of 4%, 5%, whatever stock market crash, but it's not that. It's that is a reflection of, as in 2008, as in 1997, 98, And as in other inflection points over the last 40 years, it's a reflection of the fact that there's an enormous amount of debt out there, unbelievable amount that you can't even conceive in terms of quadrillions, that cannot be paid. Everybody's gambling, creating more debt daily, every minute, every hour, in order to try to pretend to pay off the last debts. And there is quite, as expected, apparently, occasionally crises of confidence between one institution and another, that perhaps they won't be able to make up this new funny money in time to actually clear up the books.
Even electronically, you mean?
Yes, even electronically, even in nanoseconds. So the fact is that this bankruptcy is becoming more and more endemic. There is a freeze-up. We've actually gotten indications today that, and overnight last night, a freeze-up in the interbank market where the major banks, the inter-alpha banks, you've heard us talk about them a lot, the ones that were established by Rothschild just about at the same time as August 15th, 1971, they set up a whole private banking-dominated coordinating group to basically be the ones to run the world, as opposed to a Bretton Woods system, which nations would agree among themselves to have rules for long-term investment and development and cooperation and trade among themselves. But that banking grouping, it's actually very neat, isn't it, is the one that is bankrupt. And you've got major banks in that system whose stock values just yesterday went down over 10%. You know, Royal Bank of Scotland, Commerzbank, Societe Generale, all these places. And the only reason they're there at all, however, is that they are getting infusions from the Federal Reserve of the United States. The Federal Reserve, a number of months ago, opened unlimited swap lines with these European nations, and therefore the European banks. They can't get money in Europe unless they get it from the European Central Bank, but they'd rather get it from the Federal Reserve. And the Wall Street Journal and other places are actually reflecting this, saying, oh, my goodness, you know, these guys are going to take all this money out of the United States and then we're going to have a crisis. But we have to save them because, you know, we have credit default swaps on their debt, et cetera, et cetera. It's an incestuous mess. And the only way out of that is to wipe out the phony debt and go back to the physical economy dominating what our financial system will be. If you adjust your financial system, as was done with the constitutional setup of the United States, to the needs of economic growth for the nation, and therefore have a credit system based upon those needs, you basically offload all the gambling debts, all the speculative debts, all the stuff that is related to nothing but playing Monopoly, and protect the financial instruments which are related to production, which are related to supporting people, which are related to creating a future. So this is the story that it, as you said, LaRouche knew that we would hit this point if the solutions that he raised at various points along the line were not implemented. They weren't. And here we are, facing a new dark age, until the remedy immediately at hand, the first step, Glass-Steagall, along with the elimination of Obama from the presidency, and then full steam ahead with a development program led by NWAPA.
Right. And as I say, in the second half, mostly, we hear more from Carol about on the ground in her part of the country, that this is the fight, these are the lines drawn. So let's go back in history a minute. There's a couple aspects of the last 40 years. As I said, at the time, you mentioned you were involved even in circulating what Lyndon LaRouche wrote, that right after Nixon took the floated the value of the dollar and opened the way that would for successions of bubbles for casino economics for the next 40 years. And LaRouche stressed at the time what would happen in the future if this wasn't corrected.
Right. People should realize LaRouche was rather unique in having recognized that we would reach a crisis point like August 15th, 1971. All the other economists in various levels of the political sphere were saying, we have built-in stabilizers, we're never going to have a financial crisis again. LaRouche said, no, you know, if you continue on this post-industrial speculative path, you're going to have a financial crisis. And it happened, and it gave LaRouche incredible notoriety and traction on the college campuses, attention to what he had to say, which has, in a sense, only increased with his forecasting record over the last 40 years since.
Yeah, there was a textbook at the time. So Economics 101 on campuses had Paul Samuelson's textbook, which said the Depression could never happen again.
Right, right. And so this was a shock. Nixon said he was a Keynesian when he took the dollar. He floated the dollar. He did wage and price controls. He did massive cuts in terms of the massive 5% cross-the-board cut in wages and personnel in the federal government. And said, and what did he say? It sounded just like Obama. So we can compete in the international marketplace. So the
he did health reform too, so-called. That's when he ushered in.
Right. This ushered in
Health maintenance organization.
Put us on the road to fascist austerity. And that's what LaRouche said. And that is, he said, if we don't reverse this, and he had a plan already. At that time, it was a domestic plan that he put out in 1970, a year ahead of time, because this was coming. There were already financial crises in London as of 1967.
There was run on the pound, a run on the dollar.
And he had been projecting that this was going to happen. And so he had put out How to Lick a Depression in a Single Day, a reconstruction program for the U.S. economy in July of 1970. And when this Nixon event happened and put everyone in shock, we went wild with that, plus LaRouche's extensive analysis of why it had to happen. And why did it have to happen? He made it very clear. It had to happen because, as he put it then, the physical economy was being crushed under a mass of stocks, bonds, mortgages, and other flim-flam paper, right? Because what was happening was an economy in which people were making money but not producing goods. Increasingly, that happened right after Roosevelt died. We began to move away from an economy based on technological progress with the kind of major platform establishing infrastructure projects that are needed, and move to consumerism, and then wars, and then
there was real estate. That was when shopping malls first developed.
Yes, shopping malls,
for example,
real estate speculation. Then you go on into the whole shadow banking system that was described in the Angelides report and so forth, which really took off after 1971. Et cetera, et cetera. A lot of people have lived through that, and if they've looked at that Angelides report and our write-up of it, they can reacquaint themselves with the whole thing. But that's what was happening. It's been what's happening all along. And the basic solution, as LaRouche has put it forward, as each ratchet down has gone, is, as he said in 1971, you have to get rid of that cancerous mass of phony stocks, bonds, and mortgages, which don't represent any physical wealth or anything productive to anyone, and return to a credit system, which once the fictitious money values are out of the way, you invest in physical wealth that will increase the productive powers of labor. That was the gist of his program then. He elaborated it in the International Development Bank a couple years later. And
1974, I think.
Yeah, 75,
five,
I think.
Excuse me.
And at other various points. And
he ran for office in 1976 in the nation.
Right.
I will throw in here, we're doing a slight historical review. He got more petition signatures to be on the ballot in over 23 states, which had the sufficient Electoral College votes that he could have been in office. But more petition signatures showing more the base of support for this kind of thing than anyone had ever done in history. 1976.
Wow.
I remember. I think I was chairman of his campaign. Thank
yes, you.
You
were, actually. You
but
were.
That was pre-computerized, too. So people signed up and we kept track of their physical signatures. But that was the character of the turning point period.
Yes, the 1970s were a wild period. People who were born after that have no recollection of what it was like when we had a labor movement that actually went into motion as soon as they got wage cuts. I mean, on a large scale, of people who were willing to go into the streets because the gas prices were going through the ceiling and so forth. There was social motion. Then it was crushed. Right. It was crushed. And Carter did a lot to crush it, in fact, because here was a Democrat who came in attacking all the constituencies and deregulating everything. And to the extent that on a lighter scale than today, people still clung to this idea of party loyalty. And, you know, he's a Democrat and he'll be fair. They cut their own throats. And just as a lot of people are still doing with Obama today, saying, you know, we hate everything he's doing. It's actually evil. It's destroying. It's killing our people. But he's a Democrat. And what else can we do?
Yeah, Carol may have something to say
yeah,
about
she'll
this.
She'll have a lot
next
to say about that,
yeah.
I think, when,
yeah,
when things
soon,
come up.
Shortly, yeah.
Yeah, that is changing.
Well, you mentioned, just to fast forward, you mentioned this key turning point period and other inflection points later in your, I want to tell everyone, you know, this is the LaRue Show for August 20th, and what Nancy Spanis did write an editorial on what she's discussing now in the latest EIR online that's available. And you mentioned other, I mean, many things could be said, but there was the time when the wall came down and the Soviet Union split up was an opportunity for mankind. And then could you bring us up to what you
right,
want to say about
right.
anything?
Well, you had various points. After this crisis point of 1971, which began to destroy any kind of stability of financial relations between nations, actually literally meant institutionalizing the dominance of money over credit. I mean, we became a money system. And there was... That's all people were concerned about. We see that imbued in the generations that were growing up at that time and, you know, the baby boomer generation, also in generations after. Money, money, money. And this is actually a heavy ideological root of the problem we have today, where people think that's what economy is. Economy is not building the TVA, you know, or the Bonneville Dam. Economy is making money. But the Bretton Woods system did that. It separated money from the nation, you know, currency from the nation, which it eliminated sovereignty over our money, just as for every other nation. So that was the beginning of the end. And it since then, we've only had an increase in money and a erosion of the physical productive capability of the entire nation, except, you know, what we were able to live on from the Kennedy era, which, and perhaps a slight bit from the SDI, which never really took on as a full-scale crash project as LaRouche had proposed. But LaRouche kept insisting that there were solutions. In 1976, this many nations of the developing sector. We're talking about his International Development Bank, which would include the United States, which at that point was linked with the idea of a debt moratorium for the third world and returning to a hard investment program in physical infrastructure for the developing sector. You had a similar directionality was in the SDI proposal, which where the idea was
In the 1980s.
In 1982-83, mm-hmm. actually started in 1977, LaRouche said, look, you know, the way to avoid war but also to get the world economy out of the doldrums is and a crash is to have cooperation between have a scientific revolution on which the U.S. and the Soviet Union collaborate on this new physical principles method of killing ballistic missiles. And that's what was on the agenda. Reagan went a certain distance with it, then it got crushed. And what happened was what LaRouche had projected. The Soviet Union collapsed. At the time the Soviet Union collapsed, LaRouche and his wife said, okay, you know, now let's take advantage of this, and we have a danger that the West is going to collapse too. The only way they can avoid that is to reorient to physical long-term economic development. Should do it along with the newly liberated lands of the East, do it along with China, the Eurasian land bridge, and essentially shunt aside all this speculation that gets crushed by the Bush one regime and Mitterrand and Thatcher. So these are, at every point along the way, this is not just an issue of what happened in 2007 when the system literally ground to the halt. In 2007, 2008. This is something that's been a long time in the making, where consistently what LaRouche has said is, you're thinking all wrong about economy. Remember, the guys who were monetarists couldn't even forecast the breakdown of 1971. So what are you listening to them for? Listen to someone who bases their concept of economy not only on the creative powers of the individual human mind, but also on how to elaborate that in scientific progress in nation building. And we discovered along the way that we got more and more evidence that that was the basis for the whole founding of the United States, the Massachusetts Bay Colony, Alexander Hamilton and others were actually totally in tune, if not as scientifically advanced, but in terms of value, with exactly the same concept of a credit system. So that's where we are. People have to see that what we're talking about when we talk about August 15th being a turning point is not some magical thing about gold, right? There are lots of people out there, Thatcherites and others, Mount Penarinites, who really hate August 15th, 1971, just the way we do. But they could go running, or as virulently as we do, but they go running around and say, oh, it means we have to eliminate credit and go back to a gold system where every dollar is backed by gold. Wrong idea. It doesn't have to do with gold. It has to do with glorifying money. And if your money is gold and you glorify that, that's bad. If your money is currency and you glorify that, it's bad, because it's an oligarchical principle that leads to destroying human life, and increasingly en masse, as you destroy people's ability to labor and the fruits of their labor in terms of infrastructure. So that's a lesson that has to be learned, and there's incredible amount, as anyone who's even taken a peek on the LaRouche Pub site, of documentation over decades. I think the entire EIR is now online, from 1974 We have people who've been working very diligently and scanning everything so that now from 1974, the first issue onward, you have access to what was written in EIR. And you can see the thread of this concept that it's, you know, forget money as a object and look at the creative productive powers of the human mind and its ability to create conditions for scientific and technological progress. That's where the future is. And despite, you know, what people might think is ideological permutations on top of that, that's the core. You'll see that all the way through. You'll see the forecasts, and you'll see that that's the shift that has to be made right now, which starts with Glass-Steagall, but will take us to the moon and Mars, I do believe.
Yes, let's count on that. That's what we're here for. Well, Nancy, thank you. It may be that you want to leave us now.
I fear I should.
Okay, and if Carol wants to comment, she can do it behind your back because we're going to continue
it's
for half
quite
hour.
All right. She'll do it online, and she'll be totally available.
We just had a maybe that's Zeus sending a thunderbolt of complaint. Are you still connected, Carol?
We just had a glitch on the phone. I'm going to have to call her back.
Okay, that's all right. So, as I say, thank you to Nancy Spanis, who will be leaving now, and we're reconnecting to Carol Smith. And I can use this occasion for also reminding people it's time to not only have your own subscription to EIR Online, get your own password, but to subscribe for others, friends, enemies, families, and so forth. And that's LaRouchePub.com, on which the show in which you're listening is archived. And while we get Carol Smith reconnected, who's going to be speaking to us from Southern Indiana, I'll just fill people in on some of the latest developments that have been occurring in that part of the out of this region, because soon after August 2nd, and remember that was the August 1st and 2nd were the day of infamy for Congress, when they voted up what's officially called, I think it was the Budget Control Act of 2011, that was this treasonous act that was worked out between Obama and the White House, and an element of Congress who were willing to go along with this that called for bypassing Congress, completely unconstitutional, in order to devise ways to further cut living standards, to impose austerity in the United States, to pay this lousy, unworthy balloon of debt that Nancy Spanis just was speaking about, that's developed into the quadrillions of notional values over recent decades. So right soon after that, a state senator in Kentucky who's been providing leadership over many years from the Louisville area, named State Senator Perry Clark, issued a salvo also denouncing what Congress did and the act that Obama signed, and said it should be overturned. He called on people to take action against it. And he also said this has reached such a state of extreme that Lyndon LaRouche is right about this. President Obama should step down. We should make way for projects we need and for the action we need, for namely to reinstate Glass-Steagall and start to reinstate credit for the American system. Now, I think Carol Smith may have rejoined us there. Is that right?
We're still dialing. For some reason, we've had her home phone fail for some reason, and her cell, I just talked to her on it, and she should be there now, I hope.
Okay. I hear you.
Okay,
oh, Carol, very good.
Yeah.
Okay, so we can pick up now. And I was just telling people something about the fact that since that terrible treasonous vote, August 1st and 2nd in Washington, things have really picked up on the front for we must have Glass-Steagall and we must reverse what that kind of debt dictatorship deal for a super Congress. And in your part of the world, State Senator Perry Clark spoke out very strongly against it. Do you want to take off from that, Carol, and tell us what's been going on?
Well, with the unions, in Kentucky especially, the Glass-Steagall issue has flown. In Indiana, not so much. But this this letter from Perry on his letterhead here has really, really exploded the conversation about it. I was talking to Dick Miller, who used to run the meetings in Louisville for LaRouche before I did, and he's 88 years old, and he hardly gets out. And the first thing I asked him today was, have you heard about Perry Clark? He says, oh, my God, have I? That's all everybody's talking about. And like I said, he hardly gets out, so they must have called him. Anyways, I just left a meeting with the legislative and political director for the state of Kentucky for the communications workers, and they're planning a big rally, you know, against Verizon next week. And I was talking to Baru about Glass-Steagall, and he said, yeah, it's on their agenda. They're going to be inviting us in to speak on it. And it just so happened, as we were leaving where we were eating, one of the board members on the executive board was coming out, and so I gave her a flyer on Glass-Steagall, and she and Baru spoke a little bit about it. But I just talked to yesterday Ted Slechter, who has about a 3,000-member group on his email, and he wants me to send information on it. He said that he loved the Glass-Steagall, not so much the other part of Perry's letter. But the point is, it's got people talking. It's really got people talking. Some of my UAW people who it's not that they're not on board with it, but the hierarchy has to come straight from D.C. and they're waiting in Indiana, they're waiting in Kentucky, the UAW. Mm-hmm. Most of the other unions have already signed on, and the international AFL-CIO, and that fact, when I went into my union meeting Tuesday, the cap guy came up to me. I think Gretchen had talked to him about it, a while back. He came up to me, which they never do that. They never come up to me. I have to hunt them down, usually. and he said, I got your letter about the AFL-CIO National. He goes, this might change things. He goes, I'm waiting on a call from Keith Neergarden in Indianapolis, because that's where the Region 3 headquarters is for both Indiana and Kentucky. So I will be calling Keith. Hey, he was very, very pro. He just, has to wait. They have to wait for national. But we have just, this little group that we have, the GlassSteagallNow.com group, which includes about half of the Citizens Against Privatizing Social Security back from 2005.
Okay.
We have weekly meetings, and we had a meeting with Perry two nights ago to find out exactly what he, how we can best help him. So he asked us to help him put together and to flesh out these and what they meant, the resolutions that he's been putting in, starting with 2001. On the New Bretton Woods Conference. So we got from 2001 to 2010, or 2011, on all their resolutions dealing, LaRouche's resolutions dealing with the economic meltdown, as Nancy was talking about, that has been going on since, Nixon took us off gold.
Right.
Floated the exchange rates. But he wrote a letter in response to that Philip Bailey, that guy that interviewed him on the road. I'm sure everybody's heard that.
Well, they may or may not. I think you had a national public radio, which was terribly BBC connected, isn't it, out of London, and intervene to, is that the reporter that you're talking about?
Yes.
So they tried to do an interview. Go ahead, Carol.
Right, yeah, and the only thing, I am the most proud of anybody I've ever heard take on a reporter trying to control the issue. You know, the issue with Glass-Steagall and the fact, you know, we will not turn this around until we have Glass-Steagall. We won't have Glass-Steagall until we get, you know, until Obama steps down because he is bought and paid for by Wall Street. And now with the Super Congress is, you know, blatant about it. You know? So, you know, Philip just kept trying to talk about the Hitler-Obama connection. And Perry just, I mean, Perry just might as well have said, you know, shut up and listen. You answer my question. You know, when was LaRouche right? You know, that he, you know, Bailey had to throw in slanders of Lynn, you know, with 9/11 and you know, just totally trying to not talk about the elephant in the room, which is the meltdown of the national and the international economy.
Right.
Yeah. So we are going to John Miller. This friend of mine, he's actually taken over one of the, he's the new president of the America 2000 Club, which on this Tuesday night is going to have some people in to speak about organizing, but we've invited Perry to come also and give an update. And then to follow up on that, Wednesday night, we're going to, as a group, go to the Metro Dems Club meeting where John Yarmuth, the congressman who has not signed on board from Louisville,
right,
with Glass-Steagall, we're going to confront him at the Metro Dems meeting. So, Cletus Gibson, he's a carpenter, carpenters union, has invited me to speak on Glass-Steagall down at a union retreat they're going to have later on this month, or maybe it's the 1st of September. And then there's a big Democratic gathering for the state of Indiana, or at least the 8th and 9th districts in French Lick, this month also, or the beginning of next month, that we're gonna go to, because John is going to be running against Todd Young, the new Democrat or the new Republican that replaced Barron Hill in the 9th district, and he's going on this, you know, totally on the Glass-Steagall issue, relevant with that. So, you know, we've been to Fancy Farm, this big event in Kentucky. Actually, one of the state senators rode on the bus down there with him. I walked back, sat with him and talked to him and gave him Perry's letter then, you know. I mean, this was right after he had written it. And he did not seem to you know, have a problem. I mean, he didn't, to me at that point, at all. And while we were down there, Jim Pence runs this this blog. It's called Hillbilly Report, and he is it's a dynamite site. It's a really, really good site. Anyways, he told John and I that we need to write up information on Glass-Steagall and put it on there. Ted Slechter, like I said before, is another avenue, and we have John and I have started traveling around southern Indiana, educating on Glass-Steagall and, you know, talking about, you know, how both parties are so sold out to Wall Street, and the fact that, you know, we absolutely have to go back. We have to take over the Democratic Party and go back to the FDR style that, you know, cares about people. And talking about, you know, what they've been doing in Washington since, you know, at least 2007, is nothing productive for this nation. It's productive for Wall Street. And then, you know, now they're even talking about the QE3.
Yes.
And what we need are jobs. More cheap, you know, federal money won't create jobs unless the Fed forces the banks to, you know, lend for productive purposes. You know, the American system?
Yes.
0% interest rates to the banks only helps banks. So, you know, Perry calling for the reinstitution, you know, on his letterhead and with... And what the sad thing is, if he'd have just done that and not, you know, put this comparison about, you know, how we're going down the same road that that Germany did, if he hadn't put that in there, because I called for the impeachment of Obama back when I ran for Congress in 2010. Nobody even blinked. You know, they paid no attention. But because he's an elected official, you know, putting this out on letterhead, they had to react. You know, they had to do something. So I think it is just the best thing that could have ever happened to make to force the conversation.
Right. And one thing running through everything you're saying, and I have some other questions for you because you were leading the fight a few years ago in when it was a turning point period for our auto manufacturing sector. We'll get to that.
Yeah.
But running through this is it's you may want to say it's not surprising that it's state and local leaders that are leading the charge for reality as opposed to this what you've got in Washington, D.C., that has an age echelon aspect to it, namely mostly the boomers and so forth, that are into money and into cowardice. But you've got state and local leaders you're talking about, right?
Right. This is the same thing with the HBPA. You know, we had it in 100, you know, city councils. We had, what, 8 or 9 states? You know, the state houses on it, but the U.S. Congress, including John Yarmuth, never would pick it up.
Yeah. And now it's do or die, obviously.
Yeah. 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 And at least some, you know, thanks to Marcy Kaptur and Walter Jones, there are some finally getting on board with it, you know. And for the life, every time that I'm, you know, bring this up to anybody that lives in Louisville, they assume John Yarmuth is on board. They are amazed that he's not. So I'm telling them, march yourself on down there and you ask him. You tell him to get on board with this.
Yeah, you've done some. Did you do door to door? You're certainly in the constituency that's the geographic area, right, of Perry Clark.
Oh, absolutely. I went door to door, when was it, 2-3 days ago.
Okay.
And I did not get one single person that wasn't interested in the Glass-Steagall. Mm-hmm. Most of them didn't, most of these people, because I mean, it was a total random, I just stopped. I know his district. I've worked for him many, many times, door to door. And, they hadn't heard about the letter. But, you know, just everybody is for this, stopping the banks from getting money and creating jobs with that money instead. And, you know, this whole point Nancy was talking about, I remember the first time, the very first time I ever heard her speak, you know, back when we used to have the conferences.
Yes.
And she spoke on monetary credit versus monetary system, and I was, like, clueless. I didn't know what she was talking about. And I think that more than just about anything, you know, was what really got me interested in investigating and researching and reading, you know, lends free education of me to the American system of economics with, you know, control of money and protecting your industries and infrastructure, basic infrastructure across the board, which, you know, is absolutely what we have to get. And if you can get people's attention long enough, To lay that out, just to lay that out, who wouldn't agree with that?
Yeah, there's two kinds of speech, right? Wall Street speak, which you're hearing 26 hours a day now on TV, and American system conceptual speech, understanding. Well, do you want to say anything about, I know during the 2005-2006 period, speaking of inflection points, when it was when the auto companies in fiscal terms, due to the general decline and that we've had, were at a turning point, and you were help leading the charge with LaRouche Political Action Committee and Lyndon LaRouche in your area for retooling them just for American system upgrading of our infrastructure base and so forth. That's when you met a lot of people, right?
Oh yeah. The crazy thing about that, and that was the first time I ran for committeeman, and I had about 1,500 of those wonderful pamphlets on this with the blue color and the auto worker on the front, the blue green color and the auto worker on the front, and I handed out 1,500 of those in my plant, and over the years, I have come across people that, you know, never said anything to me about it, about how much they appreciated and how much they liked it and how much they wished that it would take hold, you know, because you can understand it. It was so historic too, you know, like what Walter Reuther and FDR did. But I don't know. I don't know why people don't move faster than they do. It's just it just amazes me. But the 2005 fight on that, it was right after the Social Security fight, the auto resolution fight.
Right.
And it you know, it rang bells with people. But as far as joining me and helping to convince our leaders, they did finally get on board with it, and the Metro Council actually passed that bill. I think that's the only resolution that they've ever passed that we asked them to.
That was for the draft Federal Economic Recovery Act, I think.
No, the actual name of it was the Retool the Auto Industry.
Oh, yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. 2005. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Perry Singh says, introduce a resolution into the General Assembly calling on Congress to retool the auto industry to rebuild the nation's crumbling infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, 2005. So, you know, this, like you're all talking about, that there was a history of this, watching, you know, these proposals come up, and, you know, and that's what I tell people today. I say, can you even imagine if this would have become law, the Homeowner Back Protection Act of 2007 and then 8, if that would have became law, how many people would not have lost their home? How much of this banking bailout would have happened? None. If we reorganized and put the rules back up back in 2007, 2008. And people just, you know, people just say, you're right, you're right. So that's when I always ask them to do something, to actually join in, you know, pushing this through, especially calling John Yarmuth and Todd Young. And the most amazing thing was the Tea Party reaction to the Glass-Steagall proposal.
Yeah, what's that? Go through that.
Oh, my Lord. Well, I showed it to this one guy, Tea Party guy, and, you know, I don't even remember how I met him. I guess I just went down there because I was running for Congress, you know, when the Tea Party really got started down here in Corden. And so I just asked them to, if I could address the meeting. Mm-hmm. And they did. They let me. And then, you know, I was running on the Glass-Steagall issue and impeaching Obama, and they loved both of those.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how many of them voted for me. Anyways, Steve took the proposal, and he took it on his own and made 50 copies of it and took it to the next meeting and got 17 people to sign it right there that night. Mm-hmm. And took it to Todd Young's office. And then I went to the Clarksville Tea Party, did the same exact thing. Actually, nobody took it from me and made their own copies. We took copies and they signed them right there at the meeting. Mm-hmm. And I took those to it. And Todd Young has just repeatedly said, you know, he's waiting for it to come out of committee and see if it's changed and, you know, just a line that I've heard from other, you know, in the briefing and stuff, I've heard from other ones say, and it's like, okay, they must have just wrote this up, and this is the Republicans', you know, answer to this. We're going to wait and see what it looks like coming out of committee.
Oh, yeah? Mm-hmm.
Instead of working for it and pushing for it. Mm-hmm. There's one thing here. I'm sure some of you follow Glenn Greenwald.
Okay.
Don Wilbur. Tony knows, and Stu. He's not a fan of LaRouche anymore, but, I mean, he loves the Glass-Steagall stuff. And he has written Glenn Greenwald. He has a huge site. There's a ton of people that follow him on the internet. And he has told him about Perry. He said, there's an elected Democratic official in Kentucky. Senator Perry Clark unleashed a firestorm when he released a letter calling on President Obama to resign. This action, of course, and before that he talked about, you know, the Democratic Party leadership is constantly kicking their face in the teeth and that they won't talk about it because it's not comfortable. So he tells Glenn, this, of course, Perry's action is making them very uncomfortable. And he says, should you have interest in pursuing this matter, I will forward the text of the letter, a radio interview with the local NPR affiliate, and an interview with a reporter from the local weekly newspaper. And that would go across the internet also. Mm-hmm. And I understand Perry had I just got a note from Adam saying that they interviewed Perry. He had one of his interviews, just finished one of his interviews.
Yeah, I think, in other words, you could, if one of these hours soon on the LaRouche Political Action Committee, LaRouchePAC.com, you can expect to see what Perry Clark has to say about the situation. But it certainly shows the lightning effect of truth when it breaks yeah. out of the control apparatus, which is, you're a great advocate of what you call, what do you call Kentuckiana there?
That's it, Kentuckiana.
But, and more power to you. That's the home of Henry Clay. That's the great Ohio Valley. But
yeah.
I think this is the manifestation we can want to force out into the open everywhere, right?
Yep, absolutely. And this point about, you know, Lynn has been so right. I just came across this flyer that I handed out back in 2008, and it says, no bailouts. There is a plan B. There always was. And it says, on September 27th, LaRouche says, you know, we've got to turn down this bailout scheme. And on the other side, I made this flyer, I was handing out. On the other side, you know, is today's Bring Back Glass-Steagall.
Mm-hmm.
And the point being that it was like 4 or 5 days before it went into effect, Lynn is pleading at the last minute, you know, trying to get people to wake up on September 27th, and then it goes through on, what, October 3rd?
Yeah.
They passed the bailout.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to me, it's an absolute wake-up call because, you know, at that time we were talking about the HBPA and, oh, my Lord, what kind of a world, what kind of a different world it would look like right now if we had frozen foreclosures. How many people have lost their homes in the past 4 years and the bank bailouts and these trillions of dollars and the debt ceiling and the downgrading of the credit, all of this was avoidable, and the Angelides report said that, and then the Senate Levin report reiterated that. This insane system that we're living under and allowing to rule and ruin the entire world has to stop. I mean, you know, Lynn, like Nancy was saying, all along the past, since 1971, you know, talking about warning about the trajectory we were on, the policies that were being made were leading in this direction, and now, because they never did listen, now we're right there on the abyss. And it is time.
Right.
For everyone to get on board.
And you've said, as you say, imagine what it's like. And you personally can say that about the thousands of jobs gone from the auto sector, your personal observations in that area. Would you say something about that?
Well, actually, we had at our high point when I hired on and up until 2003-04,
mm-hmm.
we had 10,000 people working at one local.
Oh, uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Huge plant, huge local. We had two plants. Building, you know, the large trucks and building the floors and the sports rights and the Rangers. And, you know, over the past, you know, 3 or 4 years, we have seen threats. If we didn't take cuts, they would close it completely. They would move to St. Louis. They would move it to up north in Michigan, close our plant. We'd lose everything. So, you know, we start open up the contract, losing things. And then, you know, that's not enough. So then they start working us every other week. And then we lose a whole shift. Our plant went from, that, you know, around 3,000 to 1,000, lost two-thirds of the people that worked there. The other plant, I think in total, we lost almost half of the number of people. And, you know, we tried to tell the Metro Council this, you know, the fact that when we were, you know, trying to convince them to get on board with the auto resolution.
Mm-hmm.
The tax base that decimated this, not only the fact of the number of people that work there, but the fact that, you know, all of the, you know, restaurants, repair anything and everything is going to suffer, not just the tax base itself, but all the businesses mm-hmm. from the people that's losing their jobs, not being able to spend money, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
But, I mean, we're very, very lucky in this climate. We're actually going back to work. You know, we got laid off not laid off. This is a totally different thing.
Mm-hmm.
The plant shut down in December to retool.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not retooling to build infrastructure. We're retooling to build another vehicle,
uh-huh.
a different vehicle,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, to get your job back is a good thing. But, you know, the trajectory is wrong, and the absolute, the working conditions are going to be horrendous because we've got a two-tiered system. So the people that, the new hires, when they hire people back, they won't make $15 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
They make half what we make.
Uh-huh.
So you're going to have that issue become an extremely uncomfortable for everybody because, you know, there's going to be some people that just can't get over that, you know?
Yeah.
If you're doing the exact same job side by side and one person's making double what the other person makes,
mm-hmm.
the plan, there's no doubt in my mind, the plan is to make it so bad and so uncomfortable that the people that make full pay are going to just retire and get the heck out of there.
Mm-hmm.
So, just, you know, it's going to be, and they've called me back because I'm utility. I'm going back in 2 weeks to start training.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think we actually are going to start production until January. And who knows what the world is going to look like in January if we do not turn this corner and you know, get back on track with Glass-Steagall and the American system of economics.
That's right. And, of course, we've talked about the last 40 years, but it doesn't mean you have the next 40 years to think about it. It's implied in everything you said, Nancy Spanis said, that this is the end of the line of this kind of thing. You mentioned next January. You're absolutely right. It could be next week. The nonlinear breakdown kind of effects, if we don't have put out there, as you're describing, in front of every Middlesex village and farm, every town, every shop floor, every opportunity.
Yeah.
That's why people who are listening in, they're on either the message line by phone or on our LaRouchePub.com archive, are probably listening in because they know that. But I think that whatever age, whatever circumstance, we have to redouble our efforts and our financial support and so forth. Let me ask you a couple more things in the remaining minutes, Carol,
mm-hmm.
because I know you were on a few months ago. We had John Miller on in your part of the world and so forth when we were really ratcheting up everything we can do on Glass-Steagall. And that was the time the Ohio was still in flood. You're based on the Ohio River. Do you have any circumstance to see the damage? You know, the White House is outstanding for not doing, not acting, not even cognizing really what ought to be done on the Ohio, the Mississippi, the Missouri, or the tremendous drought in the South. Do you want to say anything about that non-disaster relief or the scope of this at all?
I haven't seen anything. I was driving from Louisville
uh-huh.
back here today, and this last storm that went through.
Okay.
I did not realize how bad it was. I mean, there was humongous trees crashed into people's homes, and there were tons of people out working, cutting up and trying to remove that from
mm-hmm.
the homes. It was absolutely, it was just unreal. I had no idea it was that bad. But the,
well, one way to put it, go ahead.
Oh, the roads are horrible.
Mm-hmm.
They used to be, it used to be a huge difference in the counties over here in Indiana, Floyd County and Harrison County roads compared to Crawford. Now they're all looking like that. The potholes are just, we need a massive amount of infrastructure just in the roads and our bridges. It's taken years and years and years trying to get just the bridge painted, the Kennedy Bridge crossing over painted, let alone, you know, anything structural.
Uh-huh.
You know, they can't come up with the money to even paint the thing. Uh-huh. It's scary looking at. My uh-huh. sister a year ago was driving across and hit a pothole so big that it blew her tire.
Oh no.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Yeah, it's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. And I know Diane Rehm, I heard her talking on the way in one day about the absolutely horrendous lack of maintenance of our infrastructure everywhere, and the water main breaks in Louisville. You see in the paper a lot. And I don't know how old they are. And I'm sure they need replaced.
Yeah, I think it's become one thing is you have the damage in the winter, the freeze thaw, but in the heat, Houston, for example, and the areas in Texas on water mains break because, of course, the soil dries out, and any crack, the water pressure inside the pipe forces the crack to open up because of the lack of pressure, you know, because of the shift.
Yeah,
so it couldn't be more clear. Right, speaking of... As I've repeated, it's the August 20th LaRue show today, but we're pre-taping. On Friday, August 29th, all the governors of the Missouri River system are meeting in Nebraska. They're going to be a large part of the Missouri River is going to be out of its banks until mid-September. But what kind of federal action do you have? You hardly have even any recognition.
Yeah.
Of these kinds of conditions you've been talking about. And that brings us back to our role. Well, in the final thing, I also point out to people, I think the National Farmers Union in Indiana, the president there has been among several state leaders to raise a ruckus over the need for reestablishing Glass-Steagall and sent a letter to some of your congressmen in Indiana.
Yeah. Yeah, I talked to him on the phone. He was leaving the next day for Canada for a big meeting up there, and he's supposed to get in touch with me when he gets back here to do some collaborating and, you know, trying to get some more momentum going up on that and get more people, you know, verbally supporting it and talking to their congressmen in the surrounding districts.
Right. And... Well, in the final minutes, do you have anything, Carol, you've already outlined right at the beginning. You have a whole agenda of upcoming meetings and everything else. But I think one theme that runs through what you've said is this, you can't have repeated potentials where mankind doesn't act. If we and we're not saying we're leading the charge because we think the odds are good. It's just because that's what we have to do. I recommend everyone on this aspect just look at the weekly report that is done by Mr. LaRouche and his associates. It's now available on LaRouchePack.com on this matter of if it's now or never. Do you want to say anything, Carol?
My head is full. I've got papers laid out all around me. I think there is so much going on and so much I want to do. And I told whoever was talking to yesterday, I said, I cannot believe that. I didn't think I was going back until November. And now I have to go back in 2 weeks, and I'm thinking, how in the world am I going to get all this stuff that I have planned to do done? Because we were planning on going around to all the 10 largest cities in Indiana.
Okay.
That's what I did on in my campaign and talking to, oh, my gosh, so many. I tell you, the libraries, the people in the library, the women in the libraries helped so much in telling you what groups in that city to talk to, the ones that are most active, the ones that are most likely to do this thing called the common good, you know, things for the common good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, but, you know, we got redistricted, and now Seymour and Madison, a lot of the bigger cities are not even in the 9th district now.
Mm-hmm.
They moved them out. So Bloomington and Seymour might still be in it, but Clarksville, New Albany and Jeff are all right across the river from Kentucky. That's why it's called Kentuckiana, because, I mean, they're just right. They're one big, it's one same city, except for the river there.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So we're going to be hitting them as much as possible. Like I said, I thought I had 3 months to really, you know, I was just going to be going out 2 and 3 times a week, you know, just covering the Ninth District. Like you said, every cornfield. and just handing out this literature and just getting people, giving people hope, giving people the idea that, you know, that we've been in tight straits many, many times. Alexander Hamilton, you know, with the bankruptcy at the very beginning of our nation, and, you know, Lincoln and with the greenbacks, and FDR with the Great Depression. We can fix problems. Human beings have that creative capacity. And what we need to do is use, first and foremost, what works. Put the Glass-Steagall back up. And the fact, the idea of giving people hope and outline this plan, this wonderful plan of, you know, putting Glass-Steagall in, stopping the bailing out of the banks, take that money and direct it for infrastructure development jobs, which we need massively anyway, to put people to work, is the one and only best way to turn this thing around. And that, I believe, and I can see in people's eyes when I lay it out like that, mm-hmm. that you know, you're giving them hope. You're giving them something, not just, you know, we're going to fix things and no real, you know, idea of how to do it, but to lay that out, that plan out, and to see them, you know, you can see it in their eyes. Mm-hmm. You can see when people get it in their eyes, mm-hmm. and get on board. And, you know, march down to your congressman and tell him to get on board.
That's right. Those are the orders. Well, I can't think of a better way to end. The hour's gone by. So I thank you, Carol Smith, speaking to us from Kentuckiana across the river from Louisville. And Nancy Spanis earlier, who had to leave. This is Marcia Mary Baker. And so thank you. This is the end of the August 20th, 2011 LaRouche Show. Thank you very much.
Thank you.